This is the May 22 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Today, we're coming to you from the Nutrien Ag Solutions Innovation Center just to the south of Champaign, Illinois. Our thanks go to one of our panelists, Eric Snodgrass with Nutrien Ag Solutions. We'll talk with him in just a minute, along with Joe Jansen, the University of Illinois agricultural economist, and Dave Chatterton at Strategic Farm Marketing, also from Champaign, Illinois. Let's get an idea roughly from Joe and Dave, what might be on their list of items they'd like to discuss for the day. We'll start with you, Dave.
Yeah, Todd, I think a little bit of an inflection point for the markets here. We've had a little bit of a rally. We've gotten past that May WASDE report. We had the punishment in terms of price. Come off a little bit, but still not to a level, I think, that's enticing a lot of farmer movement or a lot of excitement in the marketplace. If you look at beans in particular, probably still under the cost of production, particularly for new crop. And in a pretty tough situation when it comes to new crop, we have a time horizon in front of us in the marketplace where the seasonals turn positive, particularly for corn, but the clock is definitely ticking. If we're not going to get that rally by the third week of June, let's say, we're certainly starting to turn the odds against us in terms of a price rally. So what happens here, I think, in the next 3 to 4 weeks in terms of the weather outlook, the trade deals are certainly part of that. The biofuel guidance and the current political process that's going on in the U.S., all in the mix here in terms of price. But I think it's a time to really be paying attention and tweaking your numbers here a little bit and trying to get to a point where, I hate to say it, but this may be a year where it's try and just do the best I can on beans, break even, maybe lose a little, hopefully make a little. And then, you know, the attention to be on corn and where the margins are going to be.
And then Joe Jansen from the University of Illinois, the things that you would like to discuss over the next 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, I think we're all thinking about to what extent is the market building some kind of weather premium in or into price or not. So that's obviously going to be a big story. And that's the seasonal story that happens at this time of year, May, June, July. The other part sort of and then the policy uncertainty around both biofuels and international trade. I think those are the two things that sort of maybe we get some resolution on those things in the next few weeks. But probably those are ongoing issues that sort of persist throughout the rest of this marketing year.
And we'll ask Eric Snodgrass some questions as well. That's why I left you for last, Eric. But to begin with, not a question about the weather for you, but about this innovation center and why Nutrien decided to site it here in Champaign County.
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. One, we're trying to just be at the epicenter of ag in the middle part of the country, and Champaign accomplishes that. The second thing is, we wanted to have a farm at scale to do our trials and to do all of our testing on. We didn't want something small. We wanted it to be like what a lot of folks deal with. And so, you know, Champaign County has good ground, but we're on some of the, I guess, more marginal stuff for the county. And that's good. It allows us to kind of test what a lot of our growers are going to be seeing. So it's big. It's 280 acres. We have interesting waterways. We have power lines that run through it. And so therefore, it kind of gives us a real world glimpse into kind of what we sell.
And you have access to the University of Illinois and some really good potential employees.
That's right. So the talent pipeline was huge. The biggest thing that they thought about when positioning this was that University of Illinois talent pipeline. And you go back into the main office and there are several of us with degrees from Illinois, so we're pretty proud to be here.
Let's ask you a few questions about the weather. Dave Chatterton, anything that you'd like to know?
Well, I guess I'd like to know what we're going to be looking at in the next 3 weeks, Eric. And, you know, we're getting ready to go into that seasonal time period that Joe and I both mentioned. You know, we're maybe a little bit behind in terms of development as this cool weather moves in. But once we come out of that, we're going to move towards that, you know, pollination reproductive window. And it's been an interesting spring. We got off to a very quick start. Now we're kind of bogging down. The wet areas have stayed wet, and we've got, you know, by our count, around 7 million acres still to plant in southern Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. You throw in a little bit more in Kentucky and Tennessee. Starting adding those numbers up, they don't necessarily change the narrative in a big way in terms of the balance sheet, but they can start to do that. And in the meantime, the USDA, you know, we've got this 2 billion bushel new crop carryout projected, but it's at a 181 yield, a record yield, a yield that we've never been able to achieve in the U.S. And so I guess my main question is the weather going to cooperate in a way based on where we're at today that allows us to hit that 181? Or what are the odds of that? Maybe that's a better way to say it.
I think the odds of that are small, only because to get to 181, I think I'd have to replicate for you 2009. That was about as perfect a weather as you could ever ask for growing a crop here in this part of the country. And I don't see that in the cards. Those areas you talked about, so the Mid-South, Southern Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Ohio Valley, we're actually probably going to see quite a bit of prevent plant acres down there because the timing of the rain has been such that they were flooded out early, then they couldn't get a chance to get in and get it fixed. You know, I mean, Matt Bennett, we all know Matt, like still talking to him just about how far delayed folks are around his area, and they're normally done weeks ago. We're all wearing jackets today, right? I mean, it's pretty chilly, so this crop is just sitting there. Maybe it's going to get 40 GDDs over the next 7 days, including, you know, yesterday too. But this is so this isn't the start where the crop just jumps out of the ground and gets going, which then makes you wonder how will these next 3 weeks play out, and if we do have some sort of risk going forward. In other words, is it going to be a continual narrative of rainfall disparity, right? So we've had mega flooding in places. And then, I mean, you go to the northern part of the state, the rain they just got was like the first they'd had in a long time. Is that going to be the story going forward? And then the question I get asked, which I think is most important, is if you do want to build a weather premium into this, something's got to really get out there and scare folks. And that's either, it's one of two things, right? It's either too much water or not enough. But I would tell you there's a third part to this, and that's the heat. We should definitely talk about that.
We will. Joe Jansen, you have a question?
I think, yeah, it's that heat side, and what, you know, where we really might build some premium is in if we start baking up this like crop that's maybe starting off in, you know, on a shakier foot, if you will. So let's talk about that.
All right. So we have a couple of strikes against us. I wish we had a third one. Now, when I say I wish, I'm telling you this in the perspective of, if you would like to have a big market rally and you would like to base it on weather and you want to base it on drought and heat, we're missing one critical thing right now. Actually, maybe we could say two. So here they are. We've got cold water off the coast of California. That's one thing that normally points toward a hotter, drier summer. It's only there because since winter, we've not had a subtropical jet of any substance. The polar jet has already started its northward shift, but we've not yet seen cold water emerge due to its lack of speed in the winds. We've not yet seen that cold water emerge. If that starts showing up the next, well, you said about 40 days, then that tells me that the ocean is telling me that the atmosphere's lost it. And then we're going to ridge out in the midsection of the country, and it will get hot and dry. But the other piece that's working against it is exactly what we brought up a moment ago. It's very wet. Oklahoma and Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, you know, parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri. Every major, major drought that we've had in the Midwest has started in the Mid-South. And that's kind of your sink, right? In other words, if you're going to get Gulf moisture here in summer, you can't have it be dry to our south. It'll steal the moisture first. So to tell you that we're going to have an 88 or 12 type situation, that's off the table at this point because the Mid-South's too wet. Now, that doesn't mean we can't have flash drought scenario going forward. And I'll just tell you, I mean, Todd, we've been saying it. We're in the middle of this 45-day assignment, right? Watch the Gulf of Alaska. It will be kind of the litmus test on whether or not the atmosphere is capable of giving us problems in midsummer. And it's kind of the last piece to fall.
The hurricane season is about to start. Do we have any new information that gives you information about what happens in the Gulf of Mexico and how that impacts the growing regions in the United States, maybe those southwestern areas?
Yeah, so right now, ocean temperatures in the Atlantic, where these things are born, they're about 2.5 degrees cooler than they were a year ago. So last year was hot. Doesn't mean it's not warm enough to make hurricanes, but it's starting to give us a little pause on maybe the thought process that this upcoming season is going to be huge. Now, that's a hard thing to define because you get one major hurricane that hits, then it's a huge event, right? And so that's still on the table. But right now, the National Hurricane Center is watching the potential for tropical development in the East Pacific. And that feels a bit early, right? It's May, but sure enough, we can do it any time of year. And if we start seeing them crank over there, that's going to be an interesting play against this whole drought story we've got.
I would be remiss if we did not ask you about the dry conditions and the very warm, hot temperatures in China. Yeah. In the last week, and what impact you believe that may have had or is having on their growing crops. Soybeans, rice, probably more impacted, I think, than corn. Maybe you can give me an idea there, too.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like here. We can get hot in May and June and not care, right? I mean, if the crop's young enough, it can take on the heat and it'll be okay. When I look at the NDVI data over the Manchurian Plain and the North China Plain, it looks fine. Most of where they grow corn and soybeans right now, you would not look down from space and be like, oh man, they're in trouble early. Things are not looking in good shape. And then I see the upcoming forecast, and there's this frontal boundary. We call it the Mayu Front. Actually, they call it the Mayu Front, and it sits right on the Yangtze, and it's got tons of rain coming in on it. So I'm looking for a problem there. And I'll be honest with you, I think if we need to find another problem globally, you may have to look around the Black Sea come midsummer, because some of our longer-range models are trying to hit them with pretty dry, hot conditions as well.
Tell me about that. And then we probably should check in on the maize growing areas of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Had been extremely dry. That would be in year two, maybe three for them. Give me an update.
Yeah, so look at the like 3-month drought, a monitor in parts of Mexico. And the closer you get to the U.S. border, we're just getting drier and drier and drier. And that bleeds then into parts of New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California, where they're deep into drought. You know, but this is kind of how Mexico runs. This is hot and dry, tropical, subtropical climate. So I don't know how to pin it up against the worry that these guys brought up at the beginning, which is really over what is the U.S. crop going to do going forward. So we'll need to watch it carefully. But if the central U.S. goes into really hot, dry summer conditions, Mexico's not. They'll end up having a strong monsoonal flow. It'll storm every day. It'll come all the way up in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah. And so they'll end up getting rain mid-season on that crop while we're quite dry.
I do want to ask a little bit more about Mexico, the number one importer of U.S. corn. Their planting season runs for another 2 months at this point in Mexico, according to the numbers or the maps that I see from USDA. So they've got a lot of time to get a corn crop in. How much have they been importing from the U.S. at this time, and what does that tell you about the potential exports for the crop we are putting in the ground now?
Yeah, I think, you know, they're the number one buyer of U.S. corn and have been for a number of years now, and their purchases this year well above where they were a year ago, which tells us that they are suffering from drought in the old crop or last year's crop. And they're trying to, you know, supplement their own supplies. When I look at the drought monitors and some of the things that Eric mentions, it looks like the corn growing areas continue to run dry. As you mentioned, time can change that. But for right now, the demand, I think, profile or projection for Mexico continues to look good, as does corn in general, Todd. I mean, we had weekly exports today, you know, that slowed down a little bit, but they haven't taken the seasonal kind of break that we would normally expect, and we continue to see them, I guess, overperform. I think year-to-date, marketing year-to-date, we're 28% above where we were a year ago. USDA is 12 or 13% above. So we're on pace to see, you know, the pattern that's been in place. I think maybe that is something that we should talk about. If we're not going to get weather, we're going to have to rely on the USDA to tighten that balance sheet in order to get price to react. And we're in a very similar situation with that balance sheet this year overall. With the USDA, I think last year they started at a 2.1 billion bushel new crop carryout. This year we're at 2 billion. We're moving, you know, we've moved down to this 1.4, 1.5 area. So Mexico is a big part of that. If Mexico has a better supply of corn domestically and import less, we have issues because ethanol is not growing. Political, you know, tailwinds elsewhere in terms of Canada, the Far East, certainly China in terms of if they would import corn are all, you know, a little bit questionable. We need our big star in the game. And I hate to say the drier they are, the better for us, but that's the long and the short of it.
Absolutely. Mexico is a hugely important customer. We have a tremendous advantage sitting right next to them with, you know, all the rail access and movement, you know, ability to move corn in that direction. The thing I would be a little bit cautious about is that, you know, when USDA came out with their May WASDE report, I think they built in some reasonably healthy demand into that balance sheet, with particularly with their corn export number. So I think some of that is already baked in, the idea that we would move significant amounts of corn for export next year, kind of, you know, carrying over on what's happening this year. I mean, everyone has sort of been surprised to the upside, and then we kept doing that, you know, month after month. We were surprised back in December, January, and we continue to kind of get these periodic sort of surprises in exports. So I think some of that is baked into USDA's current projections.
USDA putting that at 2.675 billion bushels. They also put out a season's average cash price still of $4.20. The two must be related, I suppose, because fairly cheap for corn, moving a lot of it into the marketplace. Are the global supplies, and I know the United States is just the largest supplier on the planet, but the global supplies enough to move that much into the export market at that price?
Yeah, I think part of the story here is low prices spurring some additional demand, right? We know that at when things get cheaper, people buy more. And that's part of the story. I think that's the one thing about that too, though, I'll say, and I think this is especially true on soybeans, is the idea that, you know, I don't think anyone's going to be motivated to make a lot of early purchases. We're not going to see new crop export sales really showing up in any significant way, even though, you know, this is sort of about the time of year where we start to see that kind of activity. We haven't seen a lot of it yet. We haven't seen, for example, China buy any new crop soybeans for next year in any meaningful way. And part of this is when prices are low, no one's really motivated to make sort of precautionary forward purchases.
One more AgEcon kinds of question in this area with that large export picture that USDA is talking about and a carry out at the end of the 25-26 season not being particularly large. I'm wondering how much flex there is in the price of futures over time and how quickly that makes it move. Is it tight enough? This is what farmers will be thinking or are already thinking, that we have a tight balance sheet. From your perspective, I guess the question really is, do we have a tight balance sheet?
On new crop, the answer is we're not really there. I mean, we're well over that 10% stocks to use number on new crop that I would sort of say is kind of maybe the knife edge, if you will, where we can start to get some movement. I don't think we're quite there. Part of that is, yeah, it's a 181 yield number. And so when you put that number down on the balance sheet, you get pretty significant production. It fills up the balance sheet pretty quick.
Yeah, Todd. I mean, the balance sheet is not, the new crop balance sheet in particular, is not tight. Now, it's close enough to a situation where with some problems in yield or significant problems of yield, if we got a, you know, 5%, 7%, 10% drop in national yield, we'd have a different story. The exportable stocks or the stocks to use among the global exporters of corn, if you take China out of the picture, are still relatively tight. And it doesn't take a lot to get that situation into an exponential reaction in terms of marketing price. But I think what I would tell you is, if you go back to the MAY-WASD and what the USDA did in terms of their demand, we talked about exports. They're projecting corn exports next year, I think it's 75 million bushels above where they were this year. So an increase again. And I think if the trade would have believed, for lack of a better term, those demand numbers, Todd, we would have had a much more bearish reaction to the market. I think that the trade is a little bit jaded in terms of where the USDA has demand. That's probably balanced out by where the USDA has yield. And so as we unfold this whole package, as you said, the timing of that from a farmer's perspective, very frustrating, because we're not going to really know until we get out into late summer and early fall.
So let's go with USDA is right, because the supply and demand table at the end of the year is what USDA says it is. So we're going to work with that. But I do have some questions, because what they have laid out to me tells me that weather is the driving force at this point. And so we need to know, no, there aren't any problems in Brazil. We need to know what's happening in Ukraine and the Black Sea, roughly speaking, some for corn, a lot more for wheat, with Russia thrown in it too. And we've talked about China so far. So what does the planet look like at this point for the growing regions?
It's kind of funny. So what I hear is you guys need a supply side shock and you want it to come from me. And so
Actually, Eric, I want you to convince China just buy a couple of corn, okay?
I'll get on the phone. Yeah, yeah. So this is why I think there might be something brewing. Okay, we're 2 years kind of removed from an El Nino event, and after El Nino events, what the atmosphere tends to do is just kind of give up a lot of its momentum compared to how it spins. That's when we tend to build up into big long wave troughs and ridges. So what's that mean? Well, it means what we're dealing with right now, right? We're getting these extended periods of the same type of weather. Now, if that carries into the middle of summer, if you get on the wrong side of it, you're on the wrong side of it. And all of a sudden it's hot and dry at the wrong time. And that is a possibility. I would say this, I don't know if this is just what people do just to me, but I've not had a farmer call me yet and say, man, things are going great. Just keep it going, right? It's everybody. I don't care if you're from Nebraska, if you're from Northern Illinois, Southern Illinois. No one has called me and said, I'm in the garden spot. And sometimes, you know, people will tell us, hey, things are off to a good start. We're doing all right. I don't even know where it is. And I've been to most of the Corn Belt in the last couple of months. So I think all eyes are going to be on the United States. Now, over in the Black Sea, they started off with a massive cold outbreak that just finished. Now they're hot again. So their temperatures have been fluctuating like ours have. NDVI-wise, look at from satellite, things don't look crazy off from normal. So you can't look over there from space and go, holy cow, there's a problem. But it's so early. We can't do that yet. Right now, the Indian monsoon is going to start early, which more than likely means much of Southeast Asia is going to be wet. So maybe this bleeds over into a discussion on things like palm oil and all that and throughout Malaysia and Indonesia. I think they're going to be very, very wet for the coming several months. But Todd, you mentioned it. Brazil came off on their second crop without problems. We thought we could find some, but we just couldn't. And as a result, you know, it looks pretty darn good right now. There is a big cold wave coming into Argentina, but I mean, who cares? It's fall, right? I mean, it is time to get cold. I don't think they have much of their crop they're going to be vulnerable to a frost. I mean, and they may touch a frost in Cordoba. So it comes back to the same thing we started with. I think the world is watching the United States, knowing that we've had major precipitation disparity problems. We've had, I mean, our drought monitor was really, really, you know, amped up on drought to start the season, double what it was a year ago. And the seasonal drought outlooks are really not good if you're in the Western Corn Belt. And that's where all the models continue to put down the risk of there being problems. But it's still, you know, it's July and August. And what's funny is when we get to July and August, all this May stuff we're talking about will be a distant memory. So it comes back to where we started, which is this discussion on time. There's about 4 or 5 weeks over which weather is either going to create a problem or it's going to ruin the prospect of where these prices could go. And I think everyone right now is waiting on a weather narrative. So what I think is going to happen, Todd, is people are going to craft that narrative, whether it's in reality or not. This is the time of year where snake oil salesmen come out of the woodwork to tell you what they think is going to happen. And I'm just going to tell you from years of experience, we do not know. There's no clear picture right now as to exactly how this is going to shake down in July. But there's risk on the table.
Speaking of that risk, we should switch supply and demand tables to soybeans. Tell me about that S&D table, what you think of it from USDA, and how it works with what you've been looking at the University of Illinois along with the Farm Doc team.
Yeah, I think on this on the bean side, I mean, we're obviously in a much more fragile state because we have so many fewer acres than we have and we had last year. Or, you know, we're sort of below typical, so that changes the narrative completely. I mean, USDA is projecting a very low level of stocks to use and low level of stocks by the end of the 25-26 marketing year. The key picture there, though, is trade and what happens with the combination of trade and biofuels policy. We've seen a number of sort of, you know, kind of like flash drops in bean oil prices, one last Friday, one last night into this morning, where that bean oil market has just kind of dropped off on a bunch of news about how, you know, biofuels policy is going to impact the demand for soybean oil. And there a lot, just I think a lot more uncertainty, and that, and coupled with, you know, a relatively tight balance sheet, means there could be some room for that market to run at some point.
Yeah, so we're still working through the RVOs. There have been paperwork shuffled around, but it's not clear exactly what's coming for soybean oil, renewable diesel in particular, maybe SAF as well. When you think about soybeans and what farmers ought to do, do you think of it as a tight supply, as something that can move with just a little push along, or does it take more?
It's going to take a little bit more, Todd. I think the trade is very uneasy about the trade front that Joe mentioned and just the whole political side of where the, particularly the bean oil demand goes. And bean oil has been the bullish stalwart of the soy complex really up to this point. We had a limit down move last week, as Joe said. We had another strong move down today based on the House reconciliation bill. Now it goes to the Senate. I'm sure it'll get changed. It'll come back. It'll go back and forth. So really, really hard to handicap where that's going to go. And in the meantime, we've got this trade situation with China that's out there brewing. And so You know, based on the carryout that the USDA printed and a decline year over year, I think the market, as I said earlier, would have reacted much stronger if they bought into that. I think it's a very much a wait and see attitude, and the funds are long a few beans here as we sit today, but not in a big way. And it doesn't, you know, just like corn, doesn't take a huge weather event to start affecting that yield. But that timing on that is more of July and August for soybeans. So it's a little bit of a hands off situation right now. And really kind of going back to Eric's comments about China, you know, I think when you look at the biggest vulnerability in the trade right now in the CBT, or at least in the paper trade, it's the short in wheat. And you've got a record short in Kansas City wheat. You've got a very large short in Chicago wheat. You've got a Matif wheat that's very short. And when you take that fund aggregate together, basically they're a record short in wheat right now. And if China's wheat crop, China's, I think, domestic wheat stocks have been drawn down to the order of almost 50 million metric tons. 50 million metric tons here over the last 2.5 years. They're tight on their domestic wheat stocks. If they have to import wheat from someone, and we get to be in that mix, wheat might be the canary in the coal mine here that kind of saves the row crop complex, or, you know, brings some life to the row crop complex.
I always thought it was oats nose, but maybe it will be wheat nose in the very near future. I want to stay with soybeans for just a second. The export market, the numbers that USDA printed, where do you think those numbers should be at this point? And what do you want to use in your supply and demand tables?
USDA is calling for, I think it's 1.6 million bushels or billion bushels of soybean exports next year. That's down a little bit. And I think that's probably a pretty good number, given sort of what we've seen and the tremendous amount of trade uncertainty. I mean, China's not buying a lot of U.S. beans, and I don't expect them to really move into that market in any significant way, given the amount of supply that's coming out of South America that was harvested and in the last few months. There's not a huge need to source beans from the United States, so we're gonna have to wait a little bit to get some confirmation on what new crop soybean export demand looks like.
China has also been behind on sourcing soybeans from Brazil. Is that concerning?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the sense that it just sort of pushes back everything and kind of perpetuates the uncertainty. Absolutely.
What are your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, you know, the Chinese soybean imports have definitely been lacking. They've been slowing down their ports a little bit, but I think that's going to be picking up, Todd. It looks like there's a record amount of, you know, beans that are going on the water from Brazil in particular, heading to China, and that they're going to continue to build their stocks, build their reserves. Their crush numbers are getting healthier and getting a little bit better along the way here. So I don't think it's a situation where China is going to have to, you know, come back to the U.S., you know, hat in hand for soybeans. To me, one of the bigger wild cards, we talked about the policy and how it relates to soybean oil and the bean crush, but really the stroke of the pen risk is the other, I guess I'll call it bullish risk out here in the marketplace. We've certainly been on the defensive side of that, but if you go on the glasses half full side of that equation, and the Trump administration is able to ink a deal that gets China to buy U.S. soybeans, you know, acquiescing for access to our capital markets or imports or however you want to put that, we have a much different situation. That bean balance sheet that Joe was discussing all of a sudden gets a lot tighter, a lot quicker, or potentially does.
Let's get a final word from each of you. I'm going to ask Eric what your final word will be, and about June 17, I believe, is the latest date. But we'll start with Joe Jansen, ag economist at the U of I. Any final word about marketing or what farmers should be considering at this time of the year?
No, I think looking for rallies, because this is a time of year when we typically see some seasonal rallies in new crop pricing, and taking advantage of them is the name of the game. And that's true. That's true year in and year out. And I think this year is setting up to be, you know, that story will play out here in the next few weeks.
Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing, your final word?
Yeah, Todd, I think Joe's got it pegged there. You know, seasonally, you need to be paying attention to your marketing right now. And these opportunities have some offers out ahead of the market. Rallies are your friends here. Unfortunately, you know, in the whole barometer of how we're marketing right now, we still have to play a little bit of defense, you know, more so on beans than on corn. But you have to be looking for those opportunities and ready to take them. I don't think we want to get to the end of the summer or deep into the summer and have that situation that Eric talked about where all of a sudden a weather, you know, event has not been conjured up or has not developed, and we don't have that lift, and all of a sudden the sellers are starting to come out into our marketplace. So trying to stay ahead of the process a little bit, I think, is your best defense right now. And I know we're not excited about prices where they're at. We didn't talk about the government program side of this and what may be coming down the road in an MFP or other types of programs. We'll save that for another discussion because that's a whole other can of worms. But, you know, keep in mind that particular point is out there as well to kind of supplement your bottom line at the end of the year.
Eric, if you could conjure up an issue someplace, that would be good. Otherwise, what is your final word for the day?
You know, I would just say this. I think we all feel as though the atmosphere has been in a bit of a cadence, and it's like to get stuck in certain configurations. And that's a wild card. Regular movement of the atmosphere where things are changing more rapidly is better. The fact that we keep drawing out these long stretches of continuous types of weather, either it's severe weather, maybe it's the drought that built in Nebraska, or even the stuff in Northern Illinois, we can't seem to break away from it. If that kind of cadence continues, then you will begin to have larger areas where there are regional disparities in rainfall, and that will start to peel away at the chance that we could even come close to 181 crop. I don't think it's in the cards right now. But you mentioned earlier, could we go down 10%? You know, knocking 20 bushels off of this, I don't see that yet either.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may hear and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org, willag.org, or search us out in your favorite podcast applications. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Eric Snodgrass, Dave Chatterton, and Joe Jansen. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.